Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So more than any other presidency that I can think of, certainly in recent history, though there might be some nostalgia in this, there is a strong emotional and psychological aspect to how we watch the Trump presidency, how people react to the Trump presidency, and to President Trump himself. It has raised all sorts of issues that we don't often talk about in presidential politics, from anger to passion to rationality and irrationality, as much as we talk about public policy and governance. And so today we're fortunate to be joined by Jesse Singel, who is a writer at large at New York Magazine, where he covers social science, politics, and as he calls it, weird internet subcultures. He's written, Jesse, for many publications, and he also received an MPA here at the Woodrow Wilson School and has been doing some great work trying to incorporate some of what he's learned about in the social sciences into our understanding of contemporary politics and contemporary life. So, Jesse, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you guys very much for having me.
So we wanted to start with this piece you wrote in New York Magazine called "Are Conservatives More Scared of Stuff Than Liberals?" In which you start by talking about President Trump's inauguration speech and some of the rhetoric and images that it conveyed. And you talk a little bit about why there seems to be more fake news for conservatives than there is for liberals. And you point to a study about this. So do conservatives see the world as a scarier place than liberals? What did you find when you looked at these studies?
Yeah, so this study was by Daniel Fessler. He's an anthropology professor at UCLA, and he basically had a bunch of people read a series of false statements. Some were sort of bland and didn't have much of an emotional valence, like exercising on an empty stomach burns more calories. Others focused on risks to people's well-being, like terrorist attacks in the U.S. have increased since September 11th. Basically, what he found was that conservatives are more likely to believe things that are false when there's sort of a scary feel to them. As I wrote, I sort of do and don't find it an interesting study. I do because, you know, there are stories you can tell where conservatives probably are more scared of certain kinds of things. I do think conservatives look at the world in a more black and white way and have more so-called need for cognitive closure, meaning they don't deal as well with ambiguity. I don't think those are particularly controversial statements from like a political psychology standpoint. But I also think liberals do this a lot too. Like right now, in the early days of the Trump administration, liberals are passing around all sorts of crazy false rumors about, you know, Trump and the evil things he might be doing. So I guess I sort of question the utility of examining these questions in a vacuum. I think a lot of it depends on the context and the current political moment.
I want to know what one of those false statements is. Hit me.
The one he focused on was terrorist attacks in the U.S. have increased since September 11th. So conservatives were more likely to rate that it's true than liberals. But as I pointed out, like if you had a, let's say you had a statement along the lines of there has been a staggering uptick in the police shooting unarmed black suspects for no reason, I imagine that more liberals than conservatives would believe that false statement. A lot of this stuff is sort of inherently politicized, in other words, and it's hard to come up with sort of false, scary statements that are politically neutral.
Right. So the difficulty there is that there's a prior, which is that blacks receive poor treatment at the hands of police, and so therefore anything that's in line with that. So that would be, like you say, cognitive closure. So coming up with, a coherent prior view of the world, and things that fit with that prior view get assimilated. Things that don't fit get examined more closely, maybe rejected.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we just make a mistake. Again, I'm happy to be politically incorrect here and say that for a lot of the stuff, conservatives are a bit more driven by fear, and I think they're a bit more authoritarian, and there are true statements you can make about the differences between liberals and conservatives or differences at the population level. I just think a lot of people assume that liberals aren't susceptible to a lot of these fake news forces, and liberals definitely are susceptible because they're also human beings with human brains.
But it is true that there's that guy, where was he, in Colorado, who made a living for a while generating false news stories, and he reported in an interview that he had a tough time with, at least within the liberal echo chamber, because he'd try to cough up he'd come up with a story, and then it would get shot down by people on some internet forum, like Facebook or what have you. And he just couldn't get anywhere with it.
Yeah, I think fake news is some of the best evidence for people who do think there's a big difference. And when BuzzFeed analyzed the most successful fake news pages on Facebook, they said they tended to lean right. I guess my question is, let's say, God forbid, Donald Trump is now president for 8 years, and you reran that same study, and you saw sort of the political valence of different fake news and which did better. My suspicion is the gap would be closed a little bit, and I'm sort of cribbing from a Brendan Nyhan column in today's New York Times in the Upshot. He basically says that when you're the out party and you're dealing with what you feel like is a threat to your country and your way of life, and especially now with a lot of uncertainty, you're probably more likely to believe this stuff.
More prone to fearful stories. So the one thing that's really notable since January 20th is that progressives are much more energized, seemingly, by threats to the existing system, where the system might be checks and balances, the system might be living in a world without nuclear rubble, like whatever it might be. Now, there's that level of energization which is characteristic of conservatives.
Yeah, yeah. And I look, if you spend any time on Twitter, you know that false stories about Trump do tend to spread pretty quickly in liberal circles. And a couple times I've made the mistake of retweeting false stuff myself. So again, it's just sort of the question of, like, if there's a difference of a few percentage points at the population level in terms of credulousness between liberals and conservatives, does that really matter? Because in the real world, there's all sorts of context, and you need to look at who's in power and the nature of the stories being spread. So, yeah, I guess I just resist sort of this idea of a clean divide between liberals and conservatives on this question.
So, yeah, I mean, the other way in which the story is told is it's so there's one, you can see this as whoever doesn't have power is going to be very scared and be susceptible. That's just a natural state of being in the opposition. But we've talked a lot on this show and with some authors about this other argument that the asymmetry that they see between the right and the left comes from institutions. And so they argue that the conservative news media is different than even the more partisan liberal outlets, and that the kind of party, the leaders, the media fuel a more ideological way of thinking about politics that might make people more fearful, more paranoid. But you're kind of pushing back against this a little bit.
You know, I'm honestly not sure I am, because it's such sort of a chicken and egg problem. Right. I think it's undeniably the case that quote-unquote mainstream conservative outlets in the U.S. are crazier than mainstream liberal outlets. Even if you just line up MSNBC and Fox News, like Fox News hosted birthers regularly. And Fox News right now isn't even all that far to the right in the grand scheme of our wonderful Breitbart world. But I don't really think you saw on MSNBC much of the left-wing equivalent of birtherism. So it could be that we're at a case.
So an example that would be, say, Bush knew about 9/11.
Yeah.
That would be an example of a false statement on the left that could break into mainstream media, but you're saying didn't get traction.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure someone is now going to Google it and see that MSNBC at some
of course
hosted a 9/11 truther. But, yeah, you know, and this is always an argument that engenders huge pushback from the right. But I think there is an asymmetry in the media environment. The question is what that says about, like, people's natural personalities and proclivity to believe garbage.
Do you think that liberals and conservatives are scared of the same kind of things? So there's a question of who's more scared, or is it about equal? But then do different things trigger them as they watch the political world unfold beyond who's in power? Are there different kinds of issues that you think, you know, play into the left and right's fears and anxieties?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think here the work of Jonathan Haidt, the social and political psychologist, is really useful. His basic idea is called moral foundations theory, which is that when it comes to our deepest, most primal senses of morality, liberals and conservatives are motivated by somewhat different things. So, you know, one of these classic horrible stories about immigrants are going to bring us diseases and sully our pure American whatever, that's not going to ever gain much traction among liberals because liberals are less freaked out by those sorts of threats to purity, as Haidt would call it. So I think the you know, that dynamic where the out-group, the out-party's members are more likely to be scared, you also have to filter that through the kinds of stories that are going to scare them.
Well, one difficulty here is coming up with which things are upstream causes, which things come along for the ride, because voting and political preference are binary. And so, for instance, if I think back to what I remember about Jonathan Haidt's work, one thing I thought about when reading it, I don't remember if it was the way he put it, was if you're conservative, you care a lot about your neighbors, your community, people right around you. And if you're liberal, that concern is there, but your concern might be, I don't know, it might be with people you've never met. You know, like a liberal might say, you know, a conservative might say, I care about my community and my community is under threat. And I can't believe you're going to come into my community and take my guns. And so, and a liberal might say, you know, I'm concerned about 30 million people who are going to lose health care and I'm never going to meet most of them, but that's important to me. And so some of that seems to be where you express your concern. Your, is your in-group some abstract large group nationally, or is your in-group your church or your town?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of what Haidt's getting at with his conception of care versus harm as one of the foundations.
Yeah.
If you have that ratcheted all the way up to the top, your sort of circle of caring is going to extend outward way beyond kin and close friends and stuff like that. So I think, yeah, that's a good example of how, you know, a story about, let's do the flip side of the immigrant disease story, which members of which party are going to be more, you know, horrified by stories about immigrants dying trying to get in this country, crossing the desert? You would think liberals, because they're more likely to care about certain types of distant people, would be more emotionally aroused by a story like that.
One question I always get on this issue, both the emotions and the news, is what do we do now? So fake news is here. If you believe it's more prevalent than before and it's easier to get out there. You're a journalist and a student of psychology, so you have both perspectives. How do you push back against this? I mean, how do we stop this from just overwhelming what you might call more respectable or mainstream journalism?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of a catastrophic problem that 30 or 40% of the country, well, I'm probably overstating it, tens of millions of Americans believe Donald Trump won the popular vote and that he had the biggest inauguration crowd in history, and you just can't really govern in a situation like that. So, I don't know. There are a few answers. One is, if you're into progressive politics, you realize that a big chunk of the country is just unreachable, and you're not going to be able to appeal to them because they're really detached from reality, which it doesn't mean they're crazy. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means they're imbibing so many terrible news sources. Like, I don't know. I don't know how you approach people like that.
Let's see. Ballpark, that would be, I've tried to estimate this, and it's something, it feels like about 15 to 20% of people. Because, for instance, if you look, an example of a data point is what you just said, belief about the popular vote. Although, you know, liberals have similar beliefs, but let's, so another example on the right would be a fraction of people who changed their mind about Vladimir Putin because Trump said so.
Right.
And so if you take another example would be fraction of people who were hardcore Trump supporters from the beginning, and that's about 40% of Republicans. And as far as I can tell, all these numbers point towards about 15 to 20% of Americans. But is that really very much worse than, say, people who really liked Father Coughlin, that hate monger back in the 19, you know, wherever it is, during World War II or before?
1930s.
And so who had a radio following that was a large fraction of people in the United States. So if this fraction of people—
But he wasn't president.
He wasn't president. And so the things that are different here are, firstly, that that's a faction that was large enough that could take over a political party.
Yeah.
Second, one of them became president. And so at some level, the inoculation seems to be something like having a strong party structure where there are priorities in the Republican Party that seem to involve just wanting to, I don't know, dismantle the safety net, but not, say, doing so with a bunch of false beliefs. And so the difficulty there is weakening of parties allows this crazy wing to get through.
Yeah, well, I mean, look what's happened to all the quote-unquote reasonable voices in the GOP. They've just been, you know, inundated by crazy rumors. And Breitbart, I mean, a big part of Breitbart's goal under Bannon was to discredit the Paul Ryans of the world and to, in many cases, help spread false or misleading rumors about them. So, yeah, I think that it, I don't know, it just more and more feels like a big chunk of America is getting left behind in terms of a basic level of critical thinking and informational fluency. And as you pointed out, this is maybe it's always been the case, maybe I'm overstating it, but in Father Coughlin's time, it wasn't the case that someone could make up crazy story like Pizzagate and immediately have that spread far and wide, like within days.
So
and
speed.
Yeah, the speed of it, the ability to turn out. I mean, remember how every time there was a new drop, people paged through the Hillary Clinton emails and they kept misinterpreting things and then spreading them without checking. So every day it was a new story, a new story, a new story. And I just think that has a more, you know, fortunately pernicious effect on politics and our ability to have conversations than standard evil demagoguery of the Father Coughlin stripe.
There's also just less editorial and production control, both from newspapers and television, in part because of technology. So that's a difference with the third. Against speed, yeah. Against the dissemination of this material. Someone could see it, retweet it to, you know, as many, someone like Mike Flynn. And then it's out there. Whereas back in the 30s, I still think there were more checks, even within the newspaper industry, for example, of getting that information out. I wanted to turn to another piece that we both enjoyed. The contact hypothesis offers hope for the world. Now, Jesse, most people don't know what the contact hypothesis is or why that should be what gives them hope at a moment where many are very anxious. But you connect it to the proposed ban, refugee ban. And I was hoping maybe you could tell us a little more about what this is and why it might be a source for optimism.
Yeah, so basically ever since social psychology first became a thing, there's been this idea that was first really proposed by Gordon Allport. He sort of pulled together all these different strands of research and suggested that when you take two groups that dislike or distrust each other, or one group dominating another or oppressing another, meaningful contact between members of the two groups could lead to prejudice reduction. And in his original formulation, there had to be certain criteria met for that to work. You know, it had to be, the example I use is you know, wealthy white Brooklyn people regularly patronize bodegas run by Arabs. And that's not really like a meaningful interaction to buy an egg and cheese at a bodega. And you're not necessarily going to reduce prejudice, you know, because one person is much higher on the social hierarchy than the other. Allport said that if you could find ways to have members of different groups interact in, you know, close to equal ways and to have common goals, that would foster understanding and reduce prejudice. So that was back around mid-century. If you fast forward to, I think it was 2006, there was a big meta-analysis that basically offers what I view as pretty solid evidence that Allport was right, that this stuff works. And it also, the results of the meta-analysis showed you don't really need all these conditions to be in place. Like you could have a looser partnership between members of two different groups that could also reduce prejudice in the long run. So, yeah, I sort of concluded the piece with, like, I went to the JFK airport protests when they broke out. And I think a lot of people were disgusted by the travel ban and, you know, protested over it. But I also think there's something much more visceral about something like that when you know someone who's Muslim or you know someone from the affected countries. And that's sort of the promise of the contact hypothesis. If we can break out of our bubbles and be less segregated, naturally people will start to look out for each other and look out for people who are members of outgroups.
So, for example, parents at an elementary school. My kid goes to an elementary school nearby and near our house. It's a public school, and so other parents. And I know parents who are Muslim. Or, example, in my building, scientific research in the U.S. is dependent on foreign scholars, and it occurred to me that actually I know people who, in fact, are getting screwed by the Muslim ban. So, you know, there's two postdocs, one floor up from me. There's a friend of mine at NYU who I discovered is, in fact, not a U.S. citizen and is of Iranian extraction. And guess what? So these are people who I know who, in fact, who are on the wrong side of that travel ban.
Yeah. And I would imagine you that makes you view the issue in something of a more visceral way than you would versus just sort of saying I'm a good liberal.
So what's the action item there? Is it like, you know, like when Mormons go around bicycling around the United States talking about the Church of Latter-day Saints, is the action item to send some poor Muslims into like Nebraska and go have them talk to people and chit-chat them? I mean, what's the action item here?
I think you know, you don't want to caricature it, but there are these. I just read a story, I forget where it took place, I mean, I think Missouri, where the interview was with this guy who held really anti-Muslim, anti-refugee views. A Syrian family moved in down the street, and he interacted with them, and he became less hateful. And obviously, it doesn't always go down like that. I mean, the clearest example is what happened when the horrors when Black Americans tried to move into white suburbs like mid-century, complete failure to desegregate there because the whites did not react with open arms. They reacted with violence and hatred. So there are definitely cases where this is a little bit too romantic of a notion because the hatred or distrust in question is so deep-seated. But I think as a general rule, what you're saying sounds cheesy, but there's something to it. It's much harder to spread crazy stories about Muslims if you know and know well even just one or two real-life Muslims.
Well, does it work under any conditions, or is some of the difference because of how the contact takes place, or is the difference with the race example, or you can think of slavery, because of the nature of the tension between the groups? Are there some boundaries to contact theory that the people who write about it outline?
Yeah. So, I mean, slavery was an example I mentioned in my piece. That's a case where obviously the two members of the two groups are not equals in any way. I mean, I think the most important thing is, like, it's not realistic for every intergroup form of contact to entail total equality. But as long as they're, like, approximately equal or working toward the same goals, that matters a lot. That helps. The other interesting sort of nugget from the research is that there are a lot of cases of contact between a majority and a minority group members where the member of the minority group will come away actually feeling a little bit worse, whereas the member of the majority group will have like some kind of warm glow that they interacted with a minority group member. So it isn't as simple as just mashing different people together. You need to really make sure they're sort of on the same team working towards a meaningful goal.
How does this match up? So the problem I'm detecting here is a geographical confound where increasingly ideologies in the United States separate by rural versus urban. And so now we have a problem where urban areas are where that one finds more diversity. Rural areas are where there may be either less diversity or you have to travel physically farther to find someone who is of a different group than your in-group.
Yeah.
And so now I'm just detecting a correlated variable problem. And I'm wondering either does that confound the conclusion for politics, or does it mean that you know, maybe are there any possible problems with these studies?
So they looked at so many of them. They looked at hundreds that all were from sort of very different cultural contexts that it's hard to make any blanket statements about all of them. I think just sort of shifting what you said toward the practical side, lot of Americans right now, again, not to denigrate conservatives, but if you're living in a rural area and your main news source is right-wing stuff that is doing a lot of immigrant and Muslim bashing, you know, in those cases, I don't think the contact hypothesis does offer much hope, because what are the odds that you're actually going to interact with a member of these groups? And I actually think there's some studies showing that the strongest anti-immigrant sentiment is not found at the border. It's found in places like, you know, Idaho and Iowa, where there are some Latinos, but they're not sort of the front lines of Latino migration to the U.S.
Yeah, it's been suggested that the real tension occurs in places where there is a change happening, not where there's a large Muslim population or an out-group population, but where the fraction of people who are in that group is actually changing rapidly so that it's noticeable, whether it be Indiana or Nebraska or what have you. If they go from, say, 0.1% to 1%, then that's noticeable, as opposed to, say, you know, a few hundred refugees showing up in Boston might not be so noticeable.
So it's like a saliency thing, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a historian named Gary Gersel who wrote in this edited book I did on George W. Bush. He wrote a whole kind of background history of Bush in Texas, growing up as governor, just his personal life. And he had constant contact in different ways, personal friendships to the kind of consumer contacts you talk about with Mexican Americans. And the argument that Gersel makes is that, you know, this was part of how he ended up certainly being on the liberal wing of immigration policy as president of the United States, fighting with his own party. But it was exactly what you're talking about, the contact in his background that led him there.
Yeah. Well, and I should say, like, I mean, I think actual in-person contact is the best. But I also think there's something to be said just to read immigrant stories. I mean, I feel bad that I'm blanking on her name, but the woman who just got deported from Texas, who had been here for, you know, 18 years, she came here from Nogales when she was 14. I mean, this, I'm speaking a little bit beyond the research here, but I think there's some contact effect from just like seeing these people as human beings rather than as members of some scary uniform outgroup.
You're talking about Rosa Maria Ortega, that woman?
Yeah.
Yeah, permanent resident, four kids, and got 8 years in prison for...
Oh, I'm sorry. No, there's two. Right. I'm sorry. There's the voter fraud raid. And then there was one of the first big stories to come out of the latest round of ICE raids. Yeah, she'd come here at 14.
Guadalupe Garcia de Rios.
Yep, exactly.
So just to conclude on this article, part of what the intensity of the response to the executive order that's now been held up in the courts isn't simply not liking the order, or it's not simply not liking President Trump. Part of this might kind of derive from the changes that have happened in the last 20 years in American society and the shifting demographics and daily experiences of most Americans makes this in some ways a even more potent issue than it otherwise might have been.
Yeah, and I think that's fair to say. And, just think of my own experience. You know, I probably didn't really know many gay people or have gay friends till I was 20 or 22, and then I didn't have Muslim friends until 26 or 28. So if you live in certain parts of the country, like, people, members of these groups are just part of your life day to day. And if you, this goes back to that rural-urban divide, which is just like, I don't think you can overstate how important that is.
Now, the third article that caught our eye, there were many, but this was the third one. Watching Donald Trump try to puzzle out what asset forfeiture means is deeply discomforting. And this starts with your observations of him speaking to a group of county sheriffs. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I'm going to mix up here criminal and civil asset forfeiture, but I'll just use the term asset forfeiture. It's this idea that in many parts of the country, they can sort of pull you over, decide on the basis of nothing that you're involved in the drug trade, and literally just take your stuff or tell you that if you don't give up your stuff, they're going to charge you with something. So it's this sort of vast, hugely profitable system through which law enforcement can just take people's stuff.
And in fact, there was a piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine several years ago about cash confiscation at traffic stops, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's also great New Yorker coverage of this stuff, too. But so Donald Trump was talking to a group of sheriffs about, I think a bunch of stuff, and one of them brings up asset forfeiture. And the exchange I highlight, it seems pretty clear that Donald Trump goes within about 2 minutes from not knowing what asset forfeiture is to having a very strong opinion about it, because this sheriff was the first person who, in a sense, whispered in his ear about it. He goes from not knowing what it is to being staunchly in favor of asset forfeiture. And he's outraged that anyone could be against this, terrible, unconstitutional policy. So I thought this offered a pretty scary glimpse at his mindset and how he forms beliefs. And I don't know, asset forfeiture is bad enough, but when you think about the behind-the-scenes decisions he has to make on the basis of imperfect information, this is not the sort of person you want with the nuclear codes.
Well, what does it tell you about how he makes these decisions? What does that story tell you?
I almost think it's going back to that concept of need for closure, like how comfortable you are with ambiguity. I don't think Donald Trump has any comfort with ambiguity. How often do you hear him express sort of a tempered view on something? In his world, it seems like everyone's a hero or a villain. Everything's good or bad. It's just this rigidly black and white thinking. And say what you will of Obama, when you read about Obama, for example, deciding what to do about Syria, it was the exact opposite. He was capable of integrating a lot of complex information and looking at imperfect alternatives and harm reduction. There's no signs that Trump has any of these cognitive skills.
Okay, I'm going to push back here.
Okay.
The pushback is you want a leader who's got a strong moral compass, who has a sense of who he is. It might have been, I'll pick an example, Ronald Reagan. It might have been that Ronald Reagan was not the guy you wanted helping you out on the SAT or whatever, sitting next to you in class. But, he's a guy who knew who he was and understood where he wanted things to go. So that's the counter argument. Now I'm going to take everything you just said. Oh, yeah, so that Trump guy, wow, he's great because he's got a strong moral compass. He knew what he thought. And in 2 minutes, he was able to come to a conclusion about a civil asset forfeiture. Man, that's a real leader. Okay, push back on that.
Yeah, well, I'll use a Woodrow Wilson school experience. When you get to the Woodrow Wilson school, the first thing they have you do is take some incredibly complicated subject and write like a one-page policy memo on it.
That's kind of long for Trump.
Well, exactly. No, he said he liked it less than that. He liked lots of pictures.
One page with pictures.
Right. They didn't let us do pictures.
Right.
But the point of the exercise is that you know, Woodrow Wilson School trains people who go on to work for think tanks or members of Congress, and they're working for their so-called principal. The principal says, I need to have a stance on this complicated issue by tomorrow. Pull together all the information you have on it to help me decide. If you have smart people working for you and you have the cognitive skills to, you know, obtain and understand a lot of information, you know, I don't think there's a problem with quickly coming to a decisive conclusion about something. But Trump does not seem like someone who could listen to 10 different opinions and weigh them appropriately and come to a conclusion. In this case, he heard one guy with a vested interest in asset forfeiture say asset forfeiture is good, and Trump sort of quickly parrots back, yeah, asset forfeiture is good. How could anyone be against it?
It seems a little bit like how a child moves through issues before they've learned a lot. They can have very strong reactions. It's often based on very little, but they'll move in the direction that fits their emotions as opposed to what they know about a subject. I mean, isn't there an element of that?
Yeah, and look, we all do that. I think the best evidence we have suggests that a lot of our politics come from sort of deep-seated emotions that we then build elaborate rationalizations around. But with Trump, the process is just like, I don't know, you can really see the sausage being made in a sense, and that's why I found it discomforting.
Have you seen it in any other, I mean, are there other instances you have in mind beyond this speech, even on the big policies, where you could see this kind of thinking playing out on the public stage?
When you hear him talk about trade deals, he seems like completely unable to grok the idea that not everything is a zero-sum game. So you know, every trade deal, someone is ripping someone off. Every deal of any sort is just someone getting one over on the other person. And to me, that reflects that need for like everything to be strongly good or bad, black or white. I can only repeat this so many times. It's just so scary to think about how this could play out in a crisis situation.
It's hard to know how much room there is for him to move in different directions with that emotion. So if you think of a kid, they can move in very different directions, contradictory directions, or you can't predict. But there is also a way of looking at Trump that there are boundaries to where he will go. There's a certain set of issues he has been consistent on. He won't push to the left, for example, on most issues very dramatically. And so I'm always trying to figure out how much of it is that knee-jerk, instantaneous, undeveloped reaction. Or how much does he really have a menu of basic ideas? And it's on some of the specifics more that you'll see.
I'm trying to imagine here the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, my God.
You know, just imagining
right.
Integrating
fire
information
away,
like, you know
away.
What? Is there a missile there? There's a missile there. Oh, that's okay. It's the Russians. They're our friends. It's fine. Or whatever the outcome might be. I mean, just the idea of integrating complex information seems like a pretty basic skill for anybody, oddly, in business as well. I mean, you would think that, for instance, just to pick an example, Rex Tillerson is probably pretty good at integrating complex information. He may not integrate it in a way that a liberal might like, but he surely is the kind of guy who might do that.
Right. Well, I mean, do you guys have in front of you the number of times Donald Trump went bankrupt? Because I don't have that number in front of me.
No,
well,
just a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
He lost money in the casino business.
Yeah.
A lot of things happen. I mean, look, he's changed political party registration more often than the White House has changed hands.
I mean, it's not simply the complexity of the information at the moment. Well, I think the other question clearly that concerns people is just mapping out, which gets to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which mapping out the consequences, the long-term consequences of any decision at a given moment. He doesn't seem to think of that, at least not on the surface. And obviously in politics, even more than business probably, given the number of different players you're talking about, the separation of power internally in the U.S. and internationally, if you don't think that way, very quickly you can get yourself, or get the country more importantly, into a pretty dangerous situation.
Well, look, imagine some potentially military crisis arises, and just think about how different it would play out if Mattis is in the room with him at that time or on the phone versus Bannon. Like, you honestly, there could be a huge swerve in how he approaches different situations that he doesn't really have a strong opinion or center on, just based on who he's talking to. And he's chosen to surround himself with, you know, with some people you could fairly say are actual white nationalists. So it's, I don't know, it's just that double punch of Trump himself having such like woolly beliefs, if you can call them that, versus surrounding himself with some pretty terrible people.
His beliefs are no more incoherent than those of rank and file cable news watchers. You know, I know plenty of people at all kinds of points on the spectrum who are perfectly pleasant people, but they're not I wouldn't pick one of them at random to make that person president.
Well, that's sort of right. That's the problem. They're harmlessly watching Fox News and voting once in a while versus Trump now runs everything.
Or, I don't know, I mean, a randomly chosen Rachel Maddow viewer. I mean, nothing against her, but a randomly chosen viewer of any cable news station. And that's sort of, it appears to be where Trump gets his information when he comments about the Lawfare blog and he says that, aha, the court didn't even cite the law. And then the Lawfare blog writer says, did you even read my post?
No, the same thing happened with the New York Times article where he said it said one thing, but in the first sentence it said the opposite of that. Yeah. I've done knee-jerk tweets, but imagine having 15 million people and just saying the first thing that comes in your head.
All right, so we've got a little echo chamber here going about how great it is to read the third paragraph of things, since we're all three people who read the third paragraph of the things.
Exactly.
So let me ask, we have a little more time, and I was actually, if we had a couple minutes, I would have been hoping to talk about what you've been doing, not simply the articles, but I've been reading your work, and you're doing something interesting. You're turning to the social sciences, really in depth and doing it extensively, and trying to incorporate it, as I said in the intro, in terms of understanding things like politics, using social psychology to bring us to a better understanding of partisanship or the executive order on the refugee ban. Some people don't like talking about what they are doing, but I hope you will. What do you imagine you can build this way in terms of journalism, integrating these two worlds?
Yeah, so I think the problem is that for a very long time, people have operated on these sort of folk theories about how voters decide things. So let me think of me. Oh, this example would probably resonate for you guys. People like Beltway pundit types will make these big proclamations about how, Americans are really worried about the deficit, or Americans don't want the government to blow up the budget. And in many cases, that's just plain false. It totally depends on the context with which you ask the question and the, no one... If you poll Americans, do you want to cut Medicare because it'll save money? They'll all say no. There's this lack of context and a lack of appreciation of the complexity that goes into how individuals form beliefs and make decisions. And that's where I think political psychology is really useful. I just want people to view human beings in a little bit of a more complex light. And I especially think I don't view myself as elite, but so-called elites, like the I-95 crowd, people who write and do academia and stuff, I think we have a tendency to sort of project our own beliefs onto voters at large and to people who don't have the time or inclination to follow politics that closely. I think political psychology and related fields are a good way out of that. Like, it's a good model for just understanding why people make the decisions they do.
How do you find relevant material? You're probably looking in sometimes very esoteric journals and trying to think through what academics might be doing at conferences, but you're writing for the public and you're writing in fun, easy to digest ways. Your articles are all like that. So how do you find A, material that's relevant, and then B, material that you will be able to translate in a way that every reader can really grapple with and understand?
Yeah, I hate Twitter for a lot of reasons, but one thing Twitter is good at is, like, if you follow people who are experts in a certain field, cool new stuff will find its way to you. So I follow a lot of social scientists, and when like an interesting new paper arrives or controversy pops up, they'll tweet about it. So it's that. There's a